Okay, so now, last week we talked about a free market system. The essence of it is individual people decide what to produce and what to buy and sell. That isn't the government making the decision. That's the heart of the free market, individual choices determining the economy. It's anchored in private property, rule of law, stable currency, low taxes. We talked about those things last week. Now, we want to say, how does this amazing thing work? How does it function? Introductory comment at the top of your outline. Does anybody need an outline? Hold up your hand. Okay. John and Twyla in the front here. There's one coming. Okay. No human being ever established a free market. It is just how human beings act when they are together in communities. They seek mutual gains from voluntary exchanges. And the picture that comes to my mind is when I was 14 years old, I traveled with my Boy Scout troop from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico. And the first night we got there, there was kind of an area where scouts from around the United States could get together and talk and chat and have some refreshments. And all these Boy Scouts were trading patches, little activity patches that you've gotten from this Klondike Derby or this local roundup contest or this camp experience. And so I got out there and I was starting to trade. Hey, I've got this beautiful patch. It's got all these colors on it. Would you like this patch for it? And so everybody's trading. It just happened. And I came away thinking, wow, I got some really good trades. I have a better collection of patches than I had when I started. But so did everybody else, as long as they traded freely. It's very interesting. But that's a free market just spontaneously happening. Whenever human beings have lived together in communities, they start to buy and sell or to trade things. And you get a lot of pictures in the Bible of people buying and selling, or traders coming from trading caravans coming from Egypt and taking Joseph into slavery, of course, but those were traders. It just happens. In order for a free market to occur in a country, the government just has to get out of the way. But also, of course, to punish crimes, and we'll talk about the rule of law in more detail next week. The point is, the point of the whole lesson is, we should be thankful to God for this amazing human process, just as we are thankful for the beauty of the natural world. So now we're going to talk about several aspects of the free market. First of all, no one decides what, how, and for whom a national economy will produce. This is amazing. People ask Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize economist, you know, in a communist system or a socialist system, the government planners, they're so wise, they sit back there in Moscow and they decide what, how many thousand bushels of wheat should be produced this year and how many thousand bushels of oats, and they decide how many winter coats should be made and how many cars should be made, and they know all this, so they set these goals way in advance so you can plan, you can get the the needed resources in line, you can get the factories lined up, you can hire the people, so you get everything that people need. Well, let me tell you, Margaret and I, many years ago now, visited St. Petersburg, what was then Leningrad, and we went in one of the big department stores, and we went in one of the big grocery stores, and it was just tragic. Just tragic. The grocery stores, shelf after shelf, just empty, and then shelves of canned vegetables and fruits where they'd have a little description on the front of what it was or a picture, but you probably didn't want to buy it. And people looking in the milk case, and I see these women coming in shopping for their families, and they'd pick up one bottle of milk after another, curdled, 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 because they could see through the glass. No good choices. And then we went into the department store, and they had winter coats. Let me tell you, they had hundreds and hundreds of brown winter coats, all the same style, and nobody buying them. Why? Because the planners couldn't anticipate what was happening. So somebody said to Milton Friedman, we know if we plan the economy, we'll know what to make, how many coats to make, how much milk to produce, all this. We can plan it in advance. But in your free market, who decides what the economy is going to produce? Who decides what's going to be made? And Milton Friedman said, no one. What? No one? Yes, no one. No one decides what is produced. And that's because, number two, the economic knowledge necessary to produce any product is widely dispersed. Even for the parts of a pencil, how do you know where you're going to get the wood, the brass, the rubber, and the factice, the paint, the lead that goes inside the graphite? For all of those things, how many people must work on it, for how long, how many pencils they have to make? Nobody can travel around the world and know firsthand all of what must be known. So how do things get made? They just do. It is amazing. And here I want to give you an example of what happened to me yesterday afternoon. At 2:30 yesterday afternoon, I drove to Home Depot to buy a pair of leather work gloves. I walked in there. I said, "Where are the gloves?" He said, "Aisle such and such. Go down on the left-hand side." And I got there, and there were these leather work gloves. And I'd gotten some before. These are great for working on bougainvillea that have those thorns, you know. And these work gloves at Home Depot, they're genuine cowhide. They cost $1.97. They're down on the bottom shelf. You've got to look for them, but they're there. They were distributed by Big Time Products in Rome, Georgia. But it says they were made in China. Now, do you think that some executive in Big Time Products in Rome, Georgia, 324 days ago said, "I think at 2:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, December 7th, Wayne Grudem is going to go to the Home Depot in Scottsdale and buy a pair of leather work gloves. We need to tell those people in China to kill another cow so they can bring it to market so we can use 1/100th of that cow to make these gloves. And then we need to tell a ship to get ready to ship, and we need to have a container company ready to ship these gloves. And we need to have people to package it up. And then we need to have people on the dock to receive it in Los Angeles when it comes in from China, and then we need to have a truck standing by ready to take it to Home Depot, and we have to time all this down to the minute, so in December 7th at 2:30, that pair of gloves is there at Home Depot." Do you think anybody said that in Rome, Georgia? No! It just happened! It happened! How did it happen? Free market. Nobody decided. The gloves just were there. Now, I think you should be saying, "Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who take pleasure in them." This is amazing, Lord. Just as you would say, "Wow, Lord, thank you for the beauty of the Rocky Mountains," or "Thank you for the beauty of this leaf on a tree," you should say, "Thank you for this amazing system." Nobody ordered the gloves, but they were there. And here's the other situation. I don't know if you draw a 5-mile radius around the Home Depot in Scottsdale. I suppose you'd have 200,000, 300,000 people. I don't know how many, something like that. It's a pretty big population. But the funny thing about Home Depot is they didn't say, "Maybe everybody in Scottsdale is going to want gloves on Saturday afternoon. We better have 217,000 pairs of gloves on hand." They didn't say that. They had 4 or 5 pairs of gloves there. Isn't that something? Who planned that exactly so that the people in Rome, Georgia would order the right amount and the people in China would kill the right amount of cows and butcher them and bring them to market? Nobody. It just happened. It's absolutely amazing. So number three, people seem to be guided by an invisible hand. They seem to be led to grow or mine or butcher or refine or supply or manufacture what is needed. And how this works was put in the famous expression coined by Adam Smith, Scottish economist, back in 1776. And here's what he says in his book, Wealth of Nations. "As every individual neither intends to promote the public interest," that means every individual does not intend to supply Wayne Grudem with a pair of leather work gloves at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon in Scottsdale at the Home Depot. "Every individual neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it, by directing his work in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value. He intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. No cattle farmer in China said, "Let me take a survey of all the people of the United States and find out how many of them will need leather work gloves at 2:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, December 7th. And so, because I really want to help the public good of the people in the United States, I just need to have a survey about a year in advance of how many people are going to need these gloves." That's intending to promote the public good. You can't do it. You don't have enough knowledge to figure it out. Too many products, too many people in the world, too many changing desires. So Adam Smith says, you know what? All they need to do is decide that they're going to produce cattle whose hide will be slaughtered for gloves so that they make a profit. As long as they do that, they promote the public good. That's my gloves. More effectively than if they had specific knowledge to do it. Is this making sense? It's absolutely astounding. All people are trying to do is make a profit or earn a living, and they end up serving the good of everybody. Number four, spontaneous human creativity that makes things useful in the free market really indicates the invisible hand that is evidence of God's amazingly wise creation, how he made us to function. So what Adam Smith called an invisible hand, I don't know if he meant by that God's direction. I suspect he did. But I do think, when I read it, that God is directing all of this. He's created a system whereby working to earn a living, we meet the needs of others. Isn't that amazing? So, the Bible has examples of human creativity to serve the needs of others. The garments that are made and sold by the godly wife in Proverbs 31:24, or Jesus as a carpenter making wooden goods or goods of other materials to meet the needs of others. Or Aquila, Priscilla, and the Apostle Paul working as tent makers, Acts 18:3. And a friend of mine who's an expert in ancient Ephesus, Steve Baugh in California, said the evidence in Acts leads him to think, and I think he's right by this, that Paul was, instead of just ordinary pup tents or something like that, he probably was making fairly luxury awnings for people to have semi-enclosed eating places and living places in their open courtyards of their homes. And he was in connection with some people who were in the higher income level of Ephesus. But the general command to work honestly with one's hands, Ephesians 4:28. In other words, people in the Bible are looked at in a positive way when they make useful goods for others. Now, how does this function? How does it function in more detail? Why does it work to produce what is needed? First of all, specialization and trade is the key to greater prosperity. And this process should amaze us and should cause thanksgiving to God. That is, some people specialize in raising cattle. Some people specialize in having factories that manufacture gloves. Some people specialize in setting up a store like Home Depot to sell goods to others. And when they specialize, everybody is better off. Let me explain. The problem is, how can people in poor countries who already work very hard produce more goods of greater value while working the same number of hours? So Barry and I say to people in poor countries, the solution to poverty is your country has to produce more. Increase your gross domestic product. And they say, I'm already working from dawn to dusk. I'm working as hard as I can. You're telling me to produce more? I can't. Physically, it's impossible. I'm already exhausted. And we are saying, there's a secret. Secret is not working harder. It's not working longer. It's specializing. Because when people specialize, you can make hundreds, thousands of times more things or more useful products than if you have to do everything yourself. So you're working dawn to dusk, but you're probably at subsistence living. So you're raising your own crops, you're cutting your own firewood, you're butchering your own chickens, and you're making your own clothes. And of course, it's tiring work because Nobody can do all that for yourself without wearing yourself out. It's impossible. But if you specialize, specialization increases productivity and innovation, allowing more to be done in less time. So, another famous passage from Adam Smith comes kind of at the beginning of his book, and we repeat it on page 168 of our book. It's Smith's famous description of the division of labor in a pin factory. And I got from Margaret a straight pin. I don't know if you can see this. It's kind of a larger one. But he takes this example of a factory for pins. Pins aren't greatly important today, but staplers were not invented and patented until 1866. So this is 100 years before that. And people would hold pieces of paper together, not with a staple, but with a pin. And then most people made their own clothing at home, so that pins were a very important part of an economy. This is a little bit long, but I think it's just fascinating, so I'm going to read it. Adam Smith says this, "To take an example, therefore, from a very trifling manufacture, but one in which the division of labor has been very often taken notice of, the trade of the pin maker. Now, a workman not educated to this business, nor acquainted with the use of the machinery employed in it, could scarce, perhaps with his utmost industry, make one pin in a day, and certainly could not make 20. But in the way in which the business is now carried on, not only the whole work is a particular trade, but it is divided into a number of branches. One man draws out the wire, another straightens it. A third cuts it, a fourth points it, a fifth grinds it at the top for receiving the head. To make the head requires two or three distinct operations. To put the head on is a peculiar business. To whiten the pins is another. It is even a trade by itself to put them in the paper. And the important business of making a pin is in this manner divided into about 18 distinct operations." That's specialization. In some manufacturing institutions, these are performed by distinct hands. In others, the same man will sometimes perform two or three of them. I have seen a small manufactory of this kind where 10 men only were employed, though they were very poor and therefore but indifferently accommodated with the necessary machinery. They could, when they exerted themselves, make up to 12 pounds of pins in a day. There are in a pound upwards of 4,000 pins of a middling size. Those 10 persons, therefore, could make among them upwards of 48,000 pins in a day. Each person, therefore, making a tenth part of 48,000 pins might be considered as making 4,800 pins in a day. But if they had all worked separately and independently without any of them having been trained in this particular business, they certainly could not each of them have made 20, perhaps not one pin in a day. Not the 4,800th part of what they are at present capable of performing in consequence of a proper division and combination of their different operations. In every other art and manufacture, the effects of the division of labor are similar to what they are in this very trifling one. So what happens is when people specialize in things, then you have different occupations and you make much, 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 much more than you could if you had to make everything all by yourself. We don't milk our own cows. We don't, although Jean and Mary Kay do raise their own eggs. Where are you, Jean and Mary Kay? back here. But most of us don't, and you sell them to other people who are out making pins or doing something. So we specialize and then we multiply our productivity. Specialization, then, allows for, then what happened? Why do we say specialization and trade? And if you've been around Barry Asmus very long, you know he uses this phrase a lot, specialization and trade, specialization and trade. Trade means after you make the pins, you get paid for them, and then you take your money and you go buy eggs from Jean and Mary Kay. Or you buy gloves from Home Depot or something else. So the trading means get the money and bring and buy other things you need. Everybody in the modern economy specializes in trades. That's why farmers are only 2% of the population. They do all the work for everybody else, and we get the food. Every poor nation must do this, must have increased specialization internally and then for export. Specialization allows for comparative advantage in trade, which benefits everyone. Comparative advantage always works, even when one has an absolute advantage. Now, this is an example from a doctor and a secretary who's a typist, but I want you to think it's same. It applies also to nations, all right? So, the doctor earns, let's say, $100 an hour, and the typist earns $15 an hour. But what if the doctor is better at typing? What if the doctor can type 120 words a minute, and the typist can only type 60 words a minute? You would think the doctor should do all the typing because he's twice as fast as the secretary, the typist. No, 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 says the economist. The doctor's time, if he's seeing patients, is worth $100 an hour. And his time, if he's typing, is only worth $15 an hour. Should he spend his time seeing patients or typing? If he spends his time seeing patients and the secretary does the typing, the doctor would type all the things that need to be done in 4 hours, but it would cost the practice $400 of lost time in seeing patients. It's more expensive than the typist who types 8 hours at $15 an hour. It costs only $120. Is that making sense? So it is with every area of life. If you can pay someone to do something else, you don't have to do it all yourself. And that's the idea of comparative advantage. Point four, this reveals the effectiveness of specialization in trading and selling, thus benefiting all. So, a poor nation might say, we don't have these big tractors and grain harvesters and all this that they have in the United States. We probably can't raise any food. Or a poor nation might say, we don't have these big textile producing machines they have in the United States. We can't produce any textiles. And on and on and on. You can always think of some other country who could do it better. But the thing is, the United States can't do everything. Germany can't do everything. England can't do everything. Other countries have to do some things, because if the United States is focusing on what it can do best, maybe making Caterpillar tractors or Boeing aircraft or computers, then those people that are working at that are not growing apples and beans and tomatoes, somebody else has to grow them. So is that making sense? There is always something for a nation to specialize in and do. A poor nation, point C, will always have a comparative advantage in making some products. So China began doing this with small manufactured goods. Asian countries began doing this with textiles. Latin American countries with food crops. Nations should specialize in order to grow its economy. And then, this is Barry's chapter. This is Barry's material. I should be having Barry explain this. He's so much more interesting and better at this than I am, but it's my class, and I felt like I better teach through the book one time and make these people guinea pigs and have to listen to me even on these economics chapters. But Barry I heard him talk about this to our seminars in China, in Beijing. Specialization in a nation will change over time. So a nation will start out making agricultural products, and then it will advance to simple manufacturing, like little toys and household goods, and then it goes to complex manufacturing, more complicated material. Then it goes to services and consumer goods, and then it moves more and more into information technologies, maybe financial services, computer services. And so it kind of progresses up a scale of specialization in more things, and when it does that, it becomes more and more economically productive. When poor countries move to more complex products, then what about us or other more developed countries? Well, we have to improve or change to producing something else. Japan was making small little toys and other manufactured goods. After World War II, they started making cars, and to tell the truth, Japan was making cars better, longer lasting than we were making them, and the same thing happened in electronics like televisions and computers. That is, they started making very good ones anyway. I don't think any televisions are manufactured in the United States anymore because other countries started to specialize. Well, wait a minute. What are those Detroit auto workers going to do? What are those television manufacturing people at RCA and whatever the plant was, what are they going to do? The answer is, there's always something new to do. All of a sudden, new businesses start up, new industries spring up. Like what? Well, how about FedEx? How about UPS? How about Amazon.com? Starbucks? The heating and air conditioning business has, because air conditioning is becoming more and more popular in the United States, that has grown a lot. So when another country can make it cheaper and better, let them do it, because there will always be something new. It frees up people to develop something new that they can do and become more prosperous still. Now, you say, wait a minute, the Detroit auto workers, all they knew was how to make cars. So, yes, there is a transition time that's difficult, and the society should do what it can to help people train for other occupations and retool and get other jobs. But in general, it's a good thing. So point C, where will displaced people find the new jobs? They'll find them in new products and new services. And we give some examples of things that did not exist 100 years ago. And all of a sudden, when farming began to shift to fewer and fewer people in the United States, more and more specialized, what did everybody else do? Think of the new products in the last 100 years. Automobiles, at least for mass manufacture. Airplanes, there's an airplane industry now, and a travel industry. Air conditioning, telephones, televisions, computers, snowmobiles, not here in Arizona, not in the southern Arizona, but snowmobiles, cell phones, iPods, iPads, Starbucks coffee, bottled water, and FedEx and UPS. If you had told me 30 years ago that I would pay for a bottle of water, I would have thought, you're crazy, it's free. But every time I get on an airplane, before I get on the airplane, I get a bottle of water. And in 50 years, there'll be an entirely different list. So, it's an amazing thing. We'll never run out of new products and opportunities because human beings have limited needs, food, clothing, shelter, but unlimited wants, and over to the next page, providing for the unlimited wants of mankind happens spontaneously in free market systems. In communist or socialist economies, it happens seldom, and they don't do it well. But the unlimited wants of people implies a competitive free market in which there will always be some jobs for those who want them, unless a government interferes by preventing new businesses from starting and prospering. Now, it's easy for you to look back and say, okay, we didn't have televisions, but now we have televisions, but now Japan is manufacturing the televisions, what are we going to do? It's always easy to say, wait, there's nothing left for us to do. But there's always something new to do, because somehow there are inventive, creative people who say, I'm going to start a new business. And Margaret and I and Stephen Kitty Ullman discovered this a week and a half ago in Washington, D.C. If you've ever been to Washington, D.C., it's not a good place to bring a car. It's just too crowded. And everything's pretty close, and so it's great. You can take taxis and get most every place, or the underground subway. But we're taking taxis, but there's a new company to replace taxis or compete with taxis, and it's called Uber, U-B-E-R. And you push you get it on your phone, and you push the little icon that says Uber, and then it says, just a second, it says, if you would like a black car to pick you up and take you someplace, at Scottsdale Bible Church, it will come in 8 minutes. Do you want it? Push the button. It's amazing. And in Washington, D.C., there are so many of these Uber cars, and they're Lincoln Town cars or they're Cadillac Escalades. I mean, they're really nice with leather seats. It costs $3 or $4 more, maybe $5 more than a taxi ride. But when it's pouring rain and you don't know how to get a taxi, you push Uber, it says be 4 minutes, and it tracks it on the map. So all of a sudden, you want an SUV instead of a black car? That'd be 13 minutes. Maybe you've got more people. So they have it here in Phoenix. It's not as developed as it is in Washington, D.C. That's a new business.
Is it an app?
It's an app. It's called UBER. You download the app, and then you have to give them your credit card information. So the black car comes. I open the door for Margaret. She gets in. I get myself in, take down the umbrella. 10 minutes later, we're at our destination. I get out of the car and say thank you. No cash because it already bills to my credit card. No tip. Tip is already included. Nice. Now look at what I said here. There will new companies will spring up. Point C, point number two, parentheses, unless government interferes by preventing new businesses from starting and prospering. Uber started in San Francisco. Who do you think objected and screamed bloody murder? The taxi. And I'll tell you, we got some dirty, rundown, beat-up taxis in Washington, D.C. Sometimes we did taxis, too. You kind of can choose either one. But the taxi drivers are just protesting. And for a while, they got them to outlaw Uber in San Francisco. They arrested a driver in Washington, D.C. They protested in Chicago. But the people who were using Uber liked it a lot. And they were really skilled at tweeting and sending text messages to their friends and getting in touch with their politician, their representatives, and the politicians back down. And the Uber is up and functioning in most major cities in the United States now. It's pretty amazing. New business starting. Isn't that interesting? But that means that it happens because a government is not outlawing it or requiring all this extensive licensing process that takes years. It's just, you want to start it, you do it. Point C, the free market has a remarkable signaling system. This process should amaze us and cause us to give thanksgiving to God. Free markets spontaneously signal to workers what jobs need to be done and to businesses what products need to be made. Do you think that some government planner sat in an office in Washington, D.C. and said, we need 10,000 more oil workers in North Dakota this year? Let me see. Let me call up the addresses and send letters to these people and demand that they go to North Dakota. Nope. What happened? All of a sudden, they started developing oil fields in North Dakota, and they were paying phenomenally high wages, and all of a sudden people were attracted and went there because they could earn so much. And they weren't getting enough, so they raised the wages even more. All of a sudden, there's a signaling system. And so the signaling system results in these gloves in the hardware store when I need them. 60,000 items in a modern hardware and building supply store, 45,000 unique items in a large grocery store, and it's just magic. They just show up on time in the quantity needed because people in the stores and the suppliers all work to try to plan what's going to be the demand, how many do I need on December 7th, and all of that. But it just happens not by government planning. If they get too much, if they order too many gloves, what happens? You're going to see them in the dollar store. They'll cut them in half and get rid of their inventory. And then the buyers are going to order next week. The market adjusts, and it brings more gloves. If there's a shortage of gloves, then Home Depot said, man, these are selling fast. I'm going to raise the price from $1.97 to $2.48 or $3.20, and then we won't sell them so fast. And all of a sudden, the buyers order more, the producers make more, the market adjusts, and the supply meets the demand. So should you worry that you won't be able to get things when you see there's a frost on the citrus crop in California or Florida, as we saw in the newspaper last week? You're going to think, I'll never be able to get oranges. I can't buy orange juice anymore. Oh, no, oh, no. Are you going to say that? No, why not? And? They'll get them from Chile or something. They'll get them from... Now, you might say, I've got to pay another 50 cents for a jar of orange or a carton of orange juice. You might think, okay, if there's a shortage, the price is going to go up a little bit, but that's how the system works, and it adjusts. The price goes up a little bit, then people can ship them from Chile, and you can get your orange juice. Now, there was another article, and this is a kind of a touchy subject, so you can make up your own mind on this, but if you happen to be one of the people who thinks it's okay to drink wine, there was an article about 3 weeks ago, and I smiled when I saw it. Article in the newspaper, worldwide wine shortage coming. More people are drinking wine, and there aren't enough vineyards that have developed to produce the wine. Should you think, if you are a person that drinks wine, and some of you don't, and I respect that too, but if you are a person that drinks wine, when you read that, would you think, oh, next year I can't buy any wine? No, you should say, I might have to pay another dollar for a bottle. I might have to pay $2 more, but there's going to be wine. If there's less of it, the prices will just go up and the market will adjust. And then when the price goes up, you know, some people who could say, I could drink wine or beer, I don't care, then they're going to shift over to beer. So the market adjusts. D, prices are the language of this amazing signaling system. Prices are an amazing source of worldwide instant economic information. This process also should amaze us and cause thanksgiving to God. Supply and demand are never constant. Prices signal how to respond. The price system is the only reliable and efficient means by which someone can track a market's complexity. Prices communicate objective information on the subjective attitudes and feelings of buyers and sellers. Poor countries must not control prices, or else signals will not work. So, Margaret and I have now a 9-month-old grandson named Will. Will is coming on December 24th to our house. We needed to get a gift for Will. So we went into a toy shop over here in Promenade in, I don't know where it is. It's by Benihana and all. Where is it? Is that Promenade or is that? Scottsdale Frank Lloyd Wright. Okay. There's this great toy store. So we go in and we say, what do you need for a 9-month-old boy? And they had this whole section. But I'll tell you, there was this little push car that he can get. It's plastic. And he can sit in it and his sister can push him or I can push him. I don't know. And I talked to the lady who owns the store and she said, yeah, those are going so fast. We had to order more of them. And we're not cutting the price on those. Why? Because the price, people were buying it, and all of a sudden, the supplier gets this signal, hey, we're selling at this price. This is a good signal. We're going to make more because we're getting more orders. So supply and demand are never constant. The prices signal how to respond. On the other hand, out in the front of the store, they have some sale items that aren't selling so well. And those manufacturers are going to get the signal, don't make so much of this little thing next year, because you're going to lose money on it because people aren't buying it. So prices signal people's subjective attitudes and feelings. That works as long as you don't control prices. But if you all of a sudden start to control prices, and this is what poor countries seem to do, oh no, this is costing people too much, we'll put a lid on the prices, then all of a sudden the pricing system can't work and you can't get the right signals and the market doesn't produce the right things. I just cannot resist saying, trying to set prices for medical insurance in the United States is also not going to work. Prices have to be free to fluctuate according to supply and demand. And once you try to control that and fix it, then there'll be all sorts of distortions and the supply won't meet the demand. And instead of paying more in money to see a doctor, you're going to pay more in a lot of lost time, waiting in line for an appointment or waiting in line at the doctor's office, because you've got to pay somehow to make the supply and the demand meet up. Point E, profits and losses are the green and red lights of the system by which consumers signal stop, go or stop. And this process, see, God also put this process in the human ability to think and to manufacture things and sell things. And this process should amaze us and cause thanksgiving to God. So what I'm saying in every step of this is, when you see 50% off, overstock, you should say, thank you, God, the market is adjusting to supply what I need. All right? And when you see orange juice prices go up 50 cents per carton because of orange juice shortage, you say, thank you, God, what an amazing system. Nobody controls it. It just adjusts. And the supply and the demand, so I can get orange juice. And so profits and losses are also wonderful things. Profits are the, and look, when I went to college, the word profit was like a swear word. It was like, companies shouldn't make profit. But no, profits are really needed. They're the incentive for improvements in products and services already present. So profit motive means that people try to make better cars than we had 50 years ago, better TVs than we used to have, better phones than we had. And profits are the incentive for developing new products like that Uber service. And they're the reward for successful innovation. So profits are a good thing because they encourage people to try and to make something new. But losses, they're hard on the person making the loss, but they also work to purify an economy of what consumers do not want. They signal producers to change, improve, or fail. And I almost put in the outline, and I thought, oh, maybe people won't know anymore what this is. I almost put in the outline, Edsel, 1957. Some of you have lived long enough, you know what I'm talking about. Ford Motor Company spent millions of dollars developing this new car that was going to be between the Ford and the Mercury in price. But it was pretty ugly, and it looked like, you know, a face of somebody sucking on a lemon with that front emblem. And they lost tons of money, millions of dollars, because what was the market saying? The market was saying, we don't like this car, stop making them. Now, if you're in Russia and the people say, we don't like this car, stop making them, the government just says back to you, buy it or don't buy one. We planned it, it's a good car, you just need to be talked into it. And it doesn't respond to market demand and supply, and so you can't get goods that work for people, that people like. But here, Ford starts losing money, and it says, okay, we'll stop making Edsels, we'll try something else. And they tried more successful models. Poor nations must not squelch profits and losses. If they squelch profits by saying, this company is making too much money, we don't like it, we're going to put excessively high taxes on them, all of a sudden you just discourage innovation, you discourage the company from producing, you discourage the company from inventing and doing better, you maybe even discourage them from working in your country. And they shouldn't discourage losses by bailouts to prevent companies from failing. If a company is failing, it's not making a profit, it's making a loss, it needs to get out of the business because it's making a product that nobody wants anymore. So, 99, 2000, I got a Palm Pilot. I thought, this is great. This is amazing. Palm Pilot. And then along came BlackBerry. Nobody wanted Palm Pilots. I think the Palm Pilot company went out of business or was absorbed by somebody else. Then along came BlackBerry. Everybody had to have BlackBerry. You can type on these little keyboards that you have. And this was a great hot thing. And then, all of a sudden, the iPhone came along. And the BlackBerry business, I think that company that owns BlackBerry that I see now, it's being bought by somebody else. It just absolutely plummeted in value because they made a... So the losses signal that people don't want it. You should go out of business. Stop producing BlackBerries. And then the Android came along, and it was replacing the iPhone. And then the iPhone came back with a new model, iPhone 5, and it's more popular than the Android or just as. So what happens is those things, losses... purify an economy of what consumers don't want. Point F, competition. Now, I said, prices are a wonderful thing. Profits and losses are a wonderful thing. Competition is a wonderful thing. We should be amazed at competition because it leads to cooperation, better products, more choices, and lower prices. This process should amaze us and cause thanksgiving to God. There is a pernicious idea in some of our educational systems, some of our schools today. We don't want competition. Give everybody the same prize. My goodness, what a horrible idea. Competition is what allows us, enables us, encourages us to make progress. So competition isn't antisocial because competition and cooperation naturally occur together and reinforce each other. This is Barry's idea too. So much of what I'm saying today, I could not have written this chapter. I honestly could not have. I didn't know all this stuff, but Barry has been teaching it for years, and he just, one after another, these are his ideas. But Barry says, market competition is the father of innovation and a constant force for making progress happen. Yes, I told about the phones. And then competition encourages and requires cooperation. Really? I thought it made us mad at people. Oh, no. Competition requires cooperation because think of how much cooperation is required to develop and manufacture and sell the iPhone. Think of how many people at Apple had to cooperate with each other in the design of this and the planning of this thing and the technology of it and the programming of it. Think of how many people in the supply chain of all the things that go into this phone from different countries had to cooperate to make the components that go in this. Think of how many people had to cooperate in the sales and advertising of it, teams of people working together for the same goal. Think of how many people had to cooperate in the stores that sell the iPhone, taking the orders. And think of how many people are kind of voluntarily working together to create new apps for it. I mean, there's an immense system of cooperation for anything that is made by a competitive enterprise trying to do it better. Let's work together as a team. And Barry gives this other example. It's the same with a woman in a poor country who makes bamboo baskets to sell in the market. She's got to depend on somebody to supply her with the bamboo. And she has to depend on somebody to supply her with the twine and somebody to provide a space for her in the marketplace so she can sell them. So she has to have friendly relationships with all these people. So cooperation comes out of competition and the consumer benefits. Poor nations must not stifle competition by protecting monopolies or by restrictive licensing of businesses. All right, point G, entrepreneurship. I'm going to come to the end because I'm running out of time. Many try, few succeed, but all of society benefits. Entrepreneurs are not seminary professors. They are people who enjoy taking risk and having an idea and trying to make it come about, and they risk their own money, and they bring great benefit to a society. Point H is a summary. Point I is how wealthy people in rich nations can genuinely help poor nations, largely by perhaps investing in for-profit enterprises in poor countries and also educational programs that teach sound economics in poor countries as well. Okay, I'm going to stop and skip over the rest of that to see if you have interaction just for a few minutes on this amazing, remarkable process that the free market works through specialization, prices, profits and losses, competition. Donna.
I just had a comment of there's so many things that we're doing in the U.S. to distort the free markets and unions with the wages and the farm subsidies. And in the paper on the way to church this morning, they talked about those solar subsidies, they're going to stop. You know, the real price of stuff is not reflected.
Yeah. So you're saying there are cases where the free market is distorted.
We're not letting the free markets work.
We're not letting free markets work because there are lots of things that hinder that, yeah. And all the examples I'm not going to respond to, I do think there's some place for employee unions to have more equal bargaining power with employers where they get very powerful, but it can be excessive and be harmful. And I'm very skeptical of subsidies for businesses that can't become profitable in the market. It's costing a lot more than needs to happen. Yes, what else? Thanks, Donna. Good. Okay, John.
You talked about price controls causing disruption in the market, and here we're controlling the most important price in the entire market, which is the interest rate.
Yeah. And it causes a disruption. Yeah. You guys are sharp. You're picking up on applications that are very troubling, where the government of the United States is very definitely hindering the free market in significant ways, and there are always consequences, harmful consequences to everybody, not just to a few. So, yeah. Good. Yeah, what's your name?
Kurt.
Wayne, is it possible that some of our problem is that the free market is almost not even a system? It's a result of good system of government, and it's actually the result of good behavior by government people and by the nature of people in a country.
Yeah.
And so to compare it to Marxism doesn't even make sense because that is a planned system.
Right.
But what we have is the absence of a system almost.
Yeah, no one decides what's made.
And so when the Pope calls it, you read a quote by the Pope that says the free market has a problem. I don't remember the quote.
Right.
It doesn't make sense because it doesn't really exist other than being freedom.
Well, you need some word to refer to all the buying and selling that goes on by everybody in the economy, buying and selling goods and buying and selling of jobs and work. And so in that way, it's a system. But you're right. It's not an organized, directed system. It just happens.
Right.
And that's what makes it so amazing. That's Adam Smith called it an invisible hand, directing people to work for their own good, but they serve the good of everybody else. Right. It's remarkable.
And you hear people criticize capitalism, it doesn't make sense, because what it is the absence of force. It's, you know, it doesn't make...
Okay, good. Thanks. Very helpful. John Harding.
Wayne, Let me
just interrupt for a second and say thank you, so many of you, for wearing the name tags. And thank you, Ron and Julie, for sorting out the name tags. So, yeah.
I think we can blame a good part of a lack of incentive in this country on government interference and regulation.
Absolutely.
We tend to create dependency, which is what government survives by doing.
Yep.
That's how they survive.
Yeah.
And they take such a big chunk out of our free market system, as you pointed out, through the tax system, through regulation, unseen ways.
Takes away incentives.
Takes away incentive.
To create
and
new
creates
businesses
and a dependency on people for generations that becomes worse, and it becomes epidemic and a disease.
Yeah, very concerning. Thank you, John. So I was doing this lesson yesterday, and I was thinking people are going to see all sorts of applications to the United States right now, and it's a cause for concern, and I think we do have a rightful cause for concern. But what we're saying in this book is to poor countries, don't make those same mistakes. Understand how this works, and let it work. It'll work well. Okay, John Blackman.
I don't think a lot of people realize that our government right now is hurting our innovation because the United States Patent Office is so poorly managed.
Yeah.
And other countries are beating us to the punch on technology. Yep. You have to be protected.
Another big concern, John, I only know a little bit about it, but our patent system has run amok, and it needs to be... There is some legislation proposed in Congress for patent reform, but whether it'll get any place, I don't know. We need a lot of change. Yes, what's your name?
Jim.
Jim, I know. Rody.
Right. Other than the... I watched your hour talk at the Family Research Council yesterday. It's been broadcast. Other than the Uber cars to and from, how do they accept what you said and what it will come out of that, do you think?
Other than what?
The Uber cars that you got to and from the
Uber cars, yeah. The Family Research Council, I was at their headquarters in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, and I think the Lord really blessed that talk, Jim. Thank you. Two of their vice presidents, Keenan Curitan and Rob Schwartzwalder, were basically coordinating the event. They had about 50 people in the event, but it was televised. They said it was several hundred online. And it's just, I'm preaching to the choir. They're in favor of free markets. They're in favor of biblical principles for economic productivity. And so it was really good in terms of my perception of how people received it. So thank you for asking. It was good.
I want to preface my question with I am a firm believer in the free market system. I think it's the best system in the world. But where in all of this production, economic goods, is there room for value judgments on what we're producing?
Uh-huh.
Now, I've been around for a long time, and I see all the phone examples. I mean, are we really better off because we've got 5G instead of 4G or 3G, and we've got this TV or that car and all the marketing that drives us?
What's your name?
Craig.
Yeah. Really helpful comment, Craig. Just thank you so much. Jamie had a powerful, powerful sermon last hour, and whatever a person sows, that will he also reap. And if we're sowing merely to material productivity and merely to material wealth and production, we're going to reap the emptiness and the hollowness of that. And so, thanks for bringing me back to this. When Barry and I are talking about how poor nations can grow from poverty to prosperity, we've got to talk about economics. And the easy examples are the gloves and the phone and the pin and all that. But what I'm going to argue next week is that the first moral advantage, second moral advantage of free market system is it allows freedom of choice for moral accountability in actions, and it allows freedom of choice for devotion to spiritual and abstract activities. So... a free market economy also enables people to build a church and have the compelled by grace program, and we've got a church building to meet in, and it enables us to drive our cars to church and meet together and spend time with friends and family and pray together and spend time in fellowship with others. The good thing is we continue to have progress in the goods we make. The temptation is our hearts get carried away by it, and we don't make sound judgments. I need an iPhone. Well, wait a minute. You didn't need to work that extra hour. You need to spend time with your family. So, I mean, there is wise judgment call that needs to be made and keep things in perspective. And thank you. I don't know if I'm repeating back exactly what your concern is, but yes, it can all get out of whack. This is not the most important stuff in the world. The most important stuff is love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. The second most important is your neighbor as yourself. This is down the list, but it's important if we're going to help the poor. That's all. Thank you. Lord, thank you. Thank you for the freedom that you give us in economic areas. Thank you for the desire to produce. And even when we seek only to earn a living for ourselves, we produce for the benefit of others. Lord, help us to be mindful of that, even in our work and even in our activities of life, that we are benefiting others in what we do. Lord, thank you for specialization and the human ability to learn specialized skills. Thank you for prices. Thank you for profits and losses. Thank you for competition. Thank you for the remarkable signaling system of the market that supply and demand just continue to adjust and match each other. What an amazing system, Lord, you have given to us. Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who take pleasure in them. Lord, we do take pleasure and delight in this system. Help us to see it and be thankful for it. And also help our hearts to be saddened at distortions of it, Lord, that we see in the world around us even this week. And we do pray for poor countries in the world, Lord, that somehow this message of how to move toward prosperity will reach leaders and that they will actually begin to help their people in a way that will be permanent and lasting. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.